So then we thought, well, if we could do something special, you know, not just be a general gig on the tour or various gigs. And so then when the idea of the Rose Bowl came up, it seemed right to do everything, like film it and everything, because it's such a special event. You know, I mean, it's something for us to be proud of forever, you know. I mean, it was, I'm sure it'll go down as one of the most important things that's happened in our career, you know.
Welcome to Breathing in Fumes, episode 14. This is Glenn from home, depeche-mode.com, and I'm really excited to welcome Tom Obarski to the podcast. Tom has an amazing story, not only just being front row at 101, or also being in the liner notes, how he got his tickets. Everything about his story just amazes me, and I hope it does that for you as well. If you're not familiar with Tom and his friends were the ones in the film that held up the big poster with the band like sketched on it, and that picture of them is in the liner notes of the album. And he tells us about the poster, of course, but so much more, you know, about how he got into the band early on, the build up to the show, the day of, just so many memories. It's just a fun conversation, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. During our conversation, though, we did have a little audio issues that I cleaned up. There's a couple dropouts, but doesn't ruin it at all. And to just get you kind of warmed up for the conversation, I put about 5-6 minutes of the broadcast from the Rose Bowl that was on K-Rock, just to kind of get you into that 1988 frame of mind. And big thanks to Tom. His stories, memories, amazing. Let's get into it. I'm Glenn. This is Breathing in Fumes.
KROQ and Avalon are proud to bring you Depeche Mode live at the Rose Bowl, a concert for the masses. Depeche Mode, a concert for the masses, June 18th at the Rose Bowl. A concert for the masses starring Depeche Mode and their special guests, OMD, Thomas Dolby, also appearing, Wire. Depeche Mode, June 18th at the Rose Bowl, a concert for the masses with their special guest, OMD, Thomas Dolby, also appearing, Wire. Tickets available now at Ticketmaster, including May Company, Music Plus, and Sport Mart stores, produced by Avalon.
Oh, delicious music on KROQ-FM, the Sugar Cubes on the Rock of the 80s, also Gang of Four and Susie and the Banshees. Doc and the Rock is with me in the broadcast booth here at the Pasadena Rose Bowl. K-Rock's on the scene. And, of course, Mr. Poor Man has wandered off somewhere. Just disappeared as usual.
Poor Man Day.
We have a one-hour broadcast for the morning show, and then we hand over to, I think, Freddie, right?
Yeah, Freddie will be here.
And he's coming in. Of course, Poor Man couldn't stay in for more than 15 minutes.
Actually, Jed, Raimondo, Ego, and I will be up here at least until 2 o'clock,
and then it's Dusty and Freddie.
Yeah,
all right. It's a terrific sight for a concert. Really, it's beautiful weather. It couldn't be better. We've got a slight haze, a slight overcast, which is going to keep the temperatures down. As we said a little earlier, Ticketmaster had released to them this morning 2,000 great seats. I think of those 2,000, there's only 1,500 left. So run to a Ticketmaster before you come to the Rose Bowl, because they have the computers. Though we have some tickets on sale here, there's only 2 ticket windows, so we can't take in a high demand, and 60,000 seats have already gone.
Traffic is no problem right now if you're headed up here. If you haven't left yet and don't know your way through Pasadena, may I recommend that if you're coming up from the south on I-5, you take the 2, the Glendale, to the 134 eastbound. Or if you're coming from the valley, obviously get on the 134, head east. If you're coming from the further eastern points, you can take the 605. Any way to get yourself to the 210. And here in Pasadena, the exits that'll get you to the Rose Bowl, for instance, Linda Vista and Orange Grove, which are the best ways in here, are clearly marked. If you come come up the 110, the Pasadena Freeway. It'll get you off on Arroyo. You can come up past, for instance, Colorado, or on Del Mar, or any of the cross streets. Get over to Orange Grove and come on up.
Okay, we found Poor Man. Before he tells you a little information about something else that's happening, we want to tell the folks that we'll be letting you know what gates to come in on our next break. And once again, want to remind you to bring some sunscreen, some hats, and some sweaters for tonight. When the sun goes down, the video screens come on, and Depeche Mode are on stage, it's going to get a little cooler. So bring those sweaters for the night and the sunscreen and hats for the day, and it's going to be a just terrific concert. Okay, Jim, what do you want to tell us?
I was just going to say, I don't know if you mentioned about the actual stage setup, but it's very cool. It says Concert for the Masses along the top. It's like a red roof and gray. It's like a house, but it's separated right where the stage is for about, I don't know, maybe 100 feet up or something like
that. So you've got a completely clear line of sight to the stage, video screens everywhere. It's going to be terrific.
Absolutely amazing looking stage setup here at the Rose Bowl. So everybody come on down. It's going to be a major party today.
Yeah, over 60,000 tickets sold already. Join your close K-Rock friends now.
Yeah, what is it, Eagle?
It's KROQ-FM, rock of the 80s and 90s on a flashback weekend, and we're broadcasting live today from the Pasadena Rose Bowl. We want you to check out the K-Rock van at the Auto Sound Challenge 88 this Sunday. That's tomorrow at the Devonshire Downs in Northridge, sponsored by Sounds Good Stereo.
Yeah!
That probably was in stereo, wasn't it, Ramondo?
On K-Rock.
We are.
I thought you went home early.
We're on the radio. This
it's
is KROQ.
We're all here.
Hello.
Hello, Jed.
Ramondo's here. Oh, that's me. Good day.
Hiya,
good day.
Hiya.
We're not supposed to broadcast during during actual music, but Wire is now doing their sound check here at the Rose Bowl.
Music?
It sounds kind of like a stuck CD, doesn't it? I think they're just testing the system. If you hear noise outside the Rose Bowl, that's what a sound check consists of. They're just checking levels and stuff.
Well, it certainly
nice,
sounds
Raymond.
Like they got a massive sound system down there, though.
Boy, they sure do. Look at this setup here. Unbelievable.
Top-notch security, too.
Now, we have some traffic problems we want to let you know about. Doc's going to tell you how to get here.
Okay, there are lots of different ways, of course, to get to the Rose Bowl, but I'm suggesting getting to the 210, like by the 605 freeway, going all the way inland, and then coming out westbound on the 210 to get off at the various Rose Bowl-marked exits. They're very easy. Or on the 134 freeway, coming from the west, coming straight through to Linda Vista or to Orange Grove. They'll also tell you Del Mar is an exit to take, but it's very confusing if you've never been here. So I suggest Linda Vista and Orange Grove. The big problem is the Pasadena Freeway. There are accidents and a brush fire and a Dodger game right at Stadium Way. So you will have kind of a trek through there. We recommend also for people coming, for instance, by limo, and some of you do, that's Lot K, parking and drop-off. If you have handicapped people, you can use Lot B here. The general public is using all the other parking lots. Crew and VIPs and staff have their own. The lots are open. May I remind you, it's $5 to park at the Rose Bowl.
And there's no hurry to get here. The first band, Wire, goes on at 3:30. Those of you who have won K-Rock pre-party passes need to be here at 2. And I think that should cover that.
Yeah. So we'll be back with some more music in just mere moments.
We are going to right now let everybody at the Rose Bowl and you people listening to K-Rock let you know just how many people are here. We're going to divide the crowd in two, this side, and we're going to see who's the rowdiest. Mr. Eagle's going to have this side and this side.
I think it's my side over there.
This is everybody on KROQ. This is incredible, folks. We're taking a team picture right now, a staff picture. Lewis, it's absolutely amazing. We're on our backs to the crowd. The whole crowd is in it, all 70,000. Say hi, Rodney.
Hey, what's happening?
Richard, say hi. We're on the radio.
We are on the radio with 70,000 people behind. Look at
Oh, this is incredible.
Oh, my goodness. Dan, don't take a dump on stage.
We got to go.
Okay. Thank you.
Tom. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me here on Breathing in Fumes.
Thanks, Glenn. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for your time and for coming on the podcast. You have an amazing story, and I can't wait to dig in on it. Before we get started, though, I'd love to hear a little bit about your history of being a Depeche Mode fan. I know you are a long, long time fan. When did you first discover the band?
Yeah, actually, I'm probably what you would call one of the elder statesmen there.
Nice.
Listening to Depeche Mode, probably it would have been late 81 or actually early 82. Obviously.
Amazing.
Like, you know, just can't get enough and stuff. I was a club kid, so that's stuff like that. So it was brought to my attention early. And once I think 83 rolled around is where the real fandom started to kick in.
Yeah, you were just kind of, they were part of the pop equation of all the stuff you were kind of absorbing. And then the series fandom started around then. When's the first time you saw the band live?
The first time would have been for the Some Great Reward tour. So I believe the L.A. area, which I lived in, was 85. And I think it was March. And
wow.
I saw them both times. And, of course, it escapes me a little bit. It was either the Palace or the Palladium, one of the two. But then the bigger show was Irvine Meadows. That was the real one that I remember quite vividly, actually.
Yeah, that was with Animotion opening, I believe. Or there was someone else in 85. Who else played that show?
It was Book of Love.
Right. Oh, I always think of them as supporting in 86, but they did support in here in that's an interesting story because Book of Love played with them here in 85. Went to Europe, and then they came back. They had a pretty big run with Depeche Mode. Well, that's really cool. And then probably every tour after you've seen them, I would think.
Every single one and multiple times, and especially the leading up to the Rose Bowl in 87, 88. I think probably every nickel that I acquired probably.
Did you see them? So they came for a small, like, 2 weeks run on that tour in 87. Did you see them on the first time they came through or just on the 88 leg?
Both times. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it would have been the Forum at the time. And I think it was a couple of nights too. So, and down to San Diego.
Oh, so you saw Voice Farm open.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's so cool. They're just kind of local heroes from this area. So I'm a huge fan of theirs. And so I haven't met many people that saw them support. Well, we say open here in the States, but support. I actually like that term better, but that's so cool. You got to see Voice Farm with them. Any memories of their set quickly? Because it was supposed to be Knights of Rad. They couldn't get in the country. So Voice Farm filled from San Francisco filled in. And do you call any memories of theirs or it's just kind of a blur?
Quite a quirky band, I remember. Obviously,
yes,
because of the Nitzareb thing. But when they came out, there were a couple of songs that really stuck with me. The Johnny Belinda and the Super EQ Team. I was like,
oh, yeah.
Very quirky, but very fun. And obviously, right after the shows, ran out and tried to locate the, you know, the dance mixes of them just to see to listen to more of them.
Yeah, they had a song called Seeing is Believing that was very Depeche Mode sounding, but the rest of it was more of like a electronic B-52s Talking Heads, kind of more like Devo-y, rooted in that world than synth pop per se. But they had one song called Seeing is Believing that's just amazing. But oh, well, that's very cool. So as we're building up to this Rose Bowl thing, what were you doing at the time? When they announced the show, where were you at? Did you hear it on K-Rock? Did you hear about it from word of mouth? How did it get on your radar? Like, oh, hey, Depeche Mode's playing the Rose Bowl. And what was your reaction?
Yeah, it was definitely K-Rock. Obviously, we heard it all just like probably most people did in Southern California with Richard Blade. And so, do you remember?
So you heard the press conference on the radio that they featured in the film.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah. I think we were sitting around having band practice at the time because of course my friends who went to the show, we were all in a band. And of course it was kind of, you know, based off of we're playing Depeche Mode songs and stuff like that. So we were all huddled around the radio listening to it like during band practice. So it was pretty exciting.
Wow. And then you've got, now you've told this story a couple times before, but I'd love to hear a little bit deeper detail. You have an amazing story of how you got your tickets for the show. And not only did you have tickets for the show, you had front row tickets for what has become one of the biggest moments in their career. Not that they haven't had amazing successes after, but it's such, I mean, I don't think an artist had played the Rose Bowl since like 1982. It wasn't like a common thing. And so, you know, it was kind of a big gamble, you know, like that part of it's kind of been overly discussed and analyzed, but I mean, this was a big deal. So being a teenager and getting front row tickets for this show was probably amazing. But now when you reflect back, like, oh my God, a front row at this moment. But can you tell us a little, tell us about the ticket story? It's just amazing. I was floored when I heard it.
Well, actually, as a teenager, I was working. I had a job at Music Plus, a local in Southern California there. And every once a year, our manager would allow us to say, OK, that concert right there, I would like to get tickets for. And she would allow us to take out the very first tickets that came out instead of handing them to the general public, drop them on the floor, and then continue to sell tickets. So, of course, my one show for the year, I said, I want the Depeche Mode one. And sure enough, I was actually there selling the tickets, dropped first.
Why did you have to drop them on the floor? What was that about?
I did not want the general public to know that we were doing this. This was kind of like a perk for working there.
So, oh, gotcha.
There. So we dropped them on the floor, continued to sell the tickets. And of course, that line, as you can imagine.
I was about to ask, how was the line? Describe the line for us.
Remember correctly, it was at least a couple of hours before the line was dispersed and everybody had their tickets and everything. It was quite the process.
Well, you know, just to kind of paint a picture here, and I didn't know this until, you know, Richard Blade in his book gave some pretty interesting insights. You know, even the label, the band, and everyone were kind of nervous about the ticket sales. And it wasn't until that evening when they found out they sold like 40 some odd thousand tickets that they could kind of relax. So as you describe this line, I'm thinking of their anxiety or panic over this day when tickets go on sale because, you know, I think Dave Gahan, according to his book anyway, made the joke 101 just might be the amount of people that show up. So the line was just kind of reflects that they sold that many tickets so quickly. Did they describe how far down it went, or just it took hours to kind of go through it?
I remember showing up for work that day, and it was a very large building that we worked in, and the line started at the front of the store. It was in a strip mall. The line went around the side of the store and was wrapped around the back of it. And it seemed like it kept adding people as the time went on. Now, obviously, the hardcore fans were there, spent the night. People were just showing up more and more. And there was a couple of artists in that day and age that could pull that kind of people and stuff like that. But for Depeche Mode to do it was definitely an anomaly, except for quite possibly the Southern California area.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were like, hey, we could easily sell, you know, 20,000, you know, because they could sell out a couple nights at the Forum or these larger venues there. And so now here's something I've always wanted to ask, and I don't know how to ask this without it sounding kind of like a passive aggressive kind of knock towards Depeche, and it's really not. Do you feel, from your perspective of being there and being a kid, you actually were in a record store selling tickets? I mean, just that alone is amazing. But do you think, did they promote it as a Depeche Mode show, or was it more focused on the 10th anniversary of K-Rock? Because it was also that as well. So when you think back to those commercials and all that, was it more that, or was it like, hey, it's Depeche Mode? Do you recall much of it being about their 10th anniversary?
Recall was that, yes, it was the 10th anniversary. I was aware of that, and because they were throwing a couple of extra bands on the bill as well.
Yeah, we'll get into them. I've never talked to anybody that saw Wire's set or Thomas Dolby's set in detail, so I don't know how we're going to make this an hour. I really don't. But anyway, what, where were, keep going. I'm sorry. I kind of derailed it there.
Poor Depeche Mode fan. To me, it was a Depeche Mode show. So the 10th anniversary was all well and good, but to buy tickets, it was, I mean, Depeche Mode was the main act.
Yeah. So when could you look at your tickets? When could you pick them up off the floor to see what your tickets were and how many did you get?
Yeah, we got six tickets was the total that we were able to get. Unfortunately, somebody else spoke up and wanted to go to the show, so I only got to keep three.
Oh, did you find out you could only keep three after they were front row, or was that before? Because that could be soul crushing.
And it was, because it was a assistant manager who found out that I did have front row, and all of a sudden she said, oh yeah, that's the show I wanted to go to as well. So farther, maybe they wouldn't have taken them, but regardless, I got to keep the three. But that was the funny thing. We didn't know that they were front row for quite a while. And even looking at the tickets didn't say row A or anything like that. We actually had to physically look at it on the map. As a matter of fact, I thought it said something like row X or row Z. It was something abnormal. So that's why I didn't think anything big until we got to see the map. And at that point, we kind of freaked out a little bit.
No, man, I you know, that's amazing. Now, I know they did K-Rock in promoting the show, did like contests. And do you recall, were they talking about it constantly, or was it just every couple of hours you heard a commercial or a promotion for a contest for this weekend? We're giving away tickets. How hard did they push it on average day when you were had the radio on?
K-Rock did promote it like it was going out of style, and you would hear about it probably multiple times in an hour. And as we got closer to the show, it got even greater, because obviously they wanted to fill the show. So they had, even though they sold thousands and thousands of tickets, they still had thousands left over because of such a big venue that like candy at the end. Now, I'm sure they were probably way up in the bleachers, the high bleachers and stuff, but they it was going all the time.
Again, to reference Richard Blade's book, I guess the day of there was like 3,000 tickets left, and they actually did sell those day of. So it was, quote unquote, a sellout for purchase tickets, not to mention all the promotional ones they gave out. So massive success there. Did you see do you recall like television commercials or anything like, again, I hate going back to one source, but Richard had his, this is a Los Angeles area and he kind of owned it, but he also had the Video One show and the band were on there. Did you watch any of those interviews?
There was lots of interviews leading up to it, and especially on the news, not so much commercials per se, but the news, the week of the show, every 11 o'clock news, you know, the 2, 4, 7s of the.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just on regular broadcast television,
stories on it, because they couldn't believe that a band such as Depeche Mode, who, you know, the general public really wasn't aware of, were selling out the Rose Bowl. So it became a big deal on the news the week of.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, I did hear that some of the other radio station like to poke a little fun at K-Rock and Depeche Mode, and you know, maybe some of the rock stations or top 40 stations. But once they found out that ticket sales went, it seems like they kind of changed their tune. Do you recall there's a tension or animosity, which kind of helped promote the show, as they talked about it negatively, helped promote the show? Do you recall any of that, or is that just kind of not as little more played up than it actually was from that you recall?
It was a little bit played up, but I think you did get the good natured ribbing from like the heavy metal or the, you know, the rock stations of the day saying, you know, who are the
KLOS or was that KLOS and Kiss FM? I'm trying to think of some big stations in LA at the time.
MET.
Which one?
T.
Well, oh, I don't remember that.
They were taking turns, you know, poking fun, thinking that a band like this would ever be able to do that. You know, their bands could reach such heights with the Ozzy Osbournes and the Motley Crues and the Van Halens of the day.
Right. Did you have any experiences prior to the show? Like, you know, maybe you were walking somewhere and you had a Depeche Mode shirt on. Did any of the fans go, hey, you going to the show? Is there any... Like, do you recall any of those kind of excitements? Like, hey, you're going to be there? You know, is it, or were you just in your friend bubble and you didn't even care?
Funny story of that is that obviously, as many young men back in the 80s in Southern California like to do, I, you know, got my garb on and did my best Dave lookalike thing. And my friend and I, who actually looked like Martin, would hang out together and we would just get mobbed wherever we walked when we would go record shopping in Hollywood or, you know, or what have you, just anything like that. We, any kind of stores, girls and guys would always stop us and talk, oh, you must like Depeche Mode because you look like them. So we would get quite a bit. It was kind of like a regular thing. As a matter of fact, I got mobbed at a show in 85 one time because I don't know why girls would think that Dave would be walking in the audience at the time.
So what happened when they attacked you? Like, they attacked you?
There were three girls, and I was with my girlfriend at the time, and these girls just jump on top of me out of the blue. I didn't see them, and I had one of those sports jackets on, kind of like Dave would have on back in the day, and they just tore that thing to shreds. So I was...
Oh, my gosh.
Something like that is what I had left on.
Wow. Did you... Were you traumatized or were you like, oh, that's pretty cool? I don't know how I would have been if that were me.
Scary, actually, the first time it happened. But then after that, oh, sure. Back in the day, you played that up and it was quite fun. And it kind of worked in our favor as we got to the show as well, because we were hit up by people and press a lot because front row and you kind of have these two guys that are lookalike. So it kind of made for a fun time.
That's really cool. Now, speaking of front row, not only were you guys front row, you were featured in the film and in the liner notes to the album because of the famous drawing, poster, sketch. I'm not sure how to call it because it's so big. I mean, so for those of you listening, if you've watched the films or flipped through the liner notes of the film soundtrack or 101 or whatever you want to call it, there's a photo of you guys in the front row holding the sign up. Tell me a little bit about how the sign came together.
Sure. We actually, leading up to the show that week, the Wednesday before the show, we were actually hanging around the Sunset Marquee in Hollywood, where Depeche Mode stayed when they came to town. And we got to meet the guys and meet the limo driver and made some nice connections and stuff. And we left the day. We had told the band, because they all came out and chatted with us, we told the band we'll be in the front row, and I'm sure they probably hear that all the time, but we went back home, and my friend, Ricky, who was the other person in the picture, as well as myself.
He's the Martin Gore.
And very distinctly, too, in the pictures. But he went home and he said, hey, we've got to do something to stand out. We're in the front row. He was an artist as well. So he got to drawing that picture 2 days before the show. So.
Wow.
And drew up that picture and said that, you know, this will, maybe the band will see it or maybe something like that. Not knowing that the thing was going to be filmed the way it was. We had heard rumors and stuff, but I didn't pay too much attention to it. I just knew that I was going to be at this gigantic show and we wanted to stand out. So hence Ricky drew that picture and it kind of did make us stand out because I'll let you in on a little side thing. I talked to Ricky recently just to refresh my memory on some of these things. And
yeah, I know we're going way back. So I appreciate you kind of knocking the cobwebs out of your mind on these memories because it was a long time ago.
Yes. And this story I didn't remember until Ricky told me, which was so great, is that I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but we're at the show and it's during the day. right before Depeche Mode's coming on and stuff like that. And this guy sits down and he starts talking to us and he's saying, I really love the picture. Why did you do it? This kind of almost like an interview. So we kind of thought maybe it was kind of the press and stuff like that. Well, he then says, he's like, I'm just asking you these questions because I'm their photographer. It was Anton the whole time. And we had no idea about
him. Wow. Yeah, because he, you know, he wasn't as much of a figure in the band's.
Right, he was.
He wasn't quite Anton linked with Depeche Mode just yet. Yeah, okay, amazing. Wow, that's so cool.
It was a great thing, and full circle. His book that just came out, what was it, a year or two ago? There is a different picture of us. In that one. Now it's the same type of thing. It shows Ricky and I in the front row holding the sign, but it's a different kind of angle and you can see Martin's outline in the sign. So that's how close we were. It's a great
picture. Wow. Now anyone who knows me knows I love all the little minutia details and everything. And I don't know how boring this would be for anybody, but I love these kind of things. So when you get to the show, because the show starts at like 3 p.m. When you're walking in or standing in lines, were there signs up or anything remotely, you know, saying, you know, if you enter past here, you're accepting that you'll be filmed? Or were there signs up that the show was being recorded, and or were there cameras that were, you know, did you see cameras rolling through, or do you recall anything of the recording of the performance?
You recall the cameras on the stage themselves, and obviously you can see in the movie when D.A. Pennybaker walks out with his cameras.
Oh, yeah.
I did know that there were cameras and such, but previous concerts, they've had cameras there before, too. So,
yeah,
that it was going to be this big production. But to your question prior to that, no signs, no nothing about filming, photography, anything like that. And to this day, we still make a joke of it that Anton owes us a bunch of royalties for being in the 101.
No, he had the liner notes. What an honor. I mean, to one, be at the show, to get free tickets, to get front row, and then to have the photo be in the liner notes. I mean, it's just amazing. Now, I don't want to jump ahead because I want to get into the show, but we need to know what happened to the poster. So I know you've kind of told the story, but let's just, you know, while we're talking about the poster, why don't you tell us a little bit about afterwards and what you guys had done with the poster?
So, leading up to the show, we met a couple of people that kind of helped us out that week. One of them was Depeche Mode's limo driver. His name was Gabby. And another gentleman was kind of like a paparazzi type guy who owned a photo shop in Hollywood. And we bought a bunch of pictures from him of Depeche Mode. And he gave us a little secret information saying, hey, this is where the after party is going to be. And this is the code to get in. So we said, okay.
Oh, the code. Nice.
Everybody, the code was David Letterman. I don't think you're.
Maybe they still use that. Now they have to change it.
After show, what we do is we go to the after party where we found out where it was, and we're hanging out. And the funny thing was, is that we had met the kids from the movie. I call them kids, the teenagers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They were going
into the after. Oh, that's so cool. I mean, I was going to ask you, do you recall seeing any of them around, you know, or do you have any memory? Because you wouldn't have known who they were prior, obviously, but, oh, so you got to see some of them. That's really cool. So they were heading into the after party.
Jump back and forth real quick. They came and they saw us in the front row and they asked to take pictures with us. Now, not knowing who they were, sure. Okay, yeah, let's take pictures with them. So we got to take pictures with some of them. And then at the after party, we saw them and we recognized them going, who are these kids that get to go into the after party here? And they came up again and recognized us from the front row and said, hey, let's get some pictures again. So they took the pictures. So those guys, pictures, that would be great to have right now. But Quinn. Subsequently, Alan shows up, chats with us a little bit. Martin shows up, goes right into the to the club. And Gabby, the limo driver, recognized us from the Sunset Marquee and said, hey, Dave is not going to be coming to the after party because he's too tired. So being bummed out a little bit about that, we were just like, well, we still have the code. We can see if we can't get into the club. So we go up there and we tell them the password, David Letterman. And they say, yeah, that's correct, but you're not getting in. And we're like, why not? And they knew we were fans. Obviously, we're holding a big sign and everything.
Yeah. Big glaring. Yeah. Oh, man. So what happened then?
Say that it was like great detective work and everything, but, you know, we can't let you in. So Gabby saw that we couldn't get in and said, hey, come on over. You guys want to sit inside their limo? OK, sure. Let us sit inside their limo. He let us come in and we sit in the limo for like, you know, 2-3 minutes and stuff like that. And long story short, the poster got left inside the limo for them when they exited the club. Now,
Very cool.
What happened to this day, where it went to and stuff like that, I'm sure, you know, where all of their stuff that them. But nonetheless, we did get to leave it inside their limo. So we do know that we got to leave it for them, which is at least a nice capper for the story.
Yeah, you'd like to think that they held on to it or that might be something they would just toss. But, you know, considering that it was in the film and, you know, they may not have even recognized it. You know, I want to put this whole story to it. Then, you know, so many hypotheticals. But, man, I hope it still exists in some vault somewhere, you know, or if they even were like, hey, that poster was the one that was in the front row. When you guys were there, do you recall anyone from the band noticing you guys there in the poster? Did, you know, Dave look down or did you have any interactions or were they just so focused on the performance?
Well, I'd like to believe that he did because he looked right at us and pointed at the sign. Once again, I'm sure everybody says, oh, he was looking at me. But we did have this one thing holding up there that he was staring at. So and I think it might even be in the movie that he kind of points. I'm not sure of that, but we do definitely remember that he definitely pointed down at the sign and, you know, kind of gave a chuckle type of thing. So it was kind of.
Yeah, very cool. Well, let's rewind a little bit. And what are your memories of walking into the show? You know, it's a sunny afternoon. Did you guys peruse around a little bit or did you go straight to your seats?
As you can imagine, with front row seats, the front row, just to make sure, because obviously it's not real until you get there.
So absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
We go right there. And the funny thing was, is that we were starting to get attention from kind of like the press people walking by and stuff like that, because, you know, here are two guys that, quote unquote, are lookalikes and have a sign and they're in the front row. How does that happen? So we were getting talked up a little bit from them and stuff like that. So we kind of got limited kind of at the front row. That was fine by me. I didn't need to go get food or anything. I don't recall eating or drinking the rest of the day because I was just happy to be in the front row. So,
wow, that's amazing. Do you now? I know K-Rock was broadcasting from the show all day. Do you recall seeing them? You know, I know they came out on stage and did a group thing and all these different other things that are kind of well known. But do you recall, was there like a booth off to the side where they were broadcasting from? I know that sounds like a weird question, but I would have, that just seemed, you know, I'm trying to find, you know, paint the picture of the other things happening at the time. Do you remember K-Rock being a presence or was it just, you know, when they walked out?
Yeah, we knew that the personalities were there as far as a booth or if they were broadcasting and stuff like that. Unfortunately for me, my whole world kind of had that little myopic view from the front row. I wasn't going anywhere. So a lot of the stuff that was on the outskirts kind of took place without my knowing because there was so much happening right there in the front row that that was kind of my world that day.
Yeah, I would have been the same way. So I would have been, just been like, yeah. Okay. So as a Wire fan, I have to ask, memories of their set. What do you recall? I mean, was it like insane? The show starts and then Wire comes out And it just, you know, I know people were still filing in and people were probably still coming in during Depeche Mode set. But what are your earliest memories as the shows of gets going and Wire set in particular?
I was excited to see them. Now, I wasn't like a huge fan, but I knew them and I was excited. I think they were added onto the bill lastly. So they were one of the last or the addition.
I know. I always felt bad about the poster because it's like Depeche Mode, OMD, Thomas Dolby, also featuring Wire. Like, oh man, it's Wire. Now I will admit, at the time, I learned Wire backwards. Like, I only knew like when they became more popular. It was later that I went back and discovered their punk roots and how influential and what a big deal they were. But my introduction to them was the late '80s with eardrum buzz and all that. I'm not saying I was, first in, first floor with Wire, but I was a fan and have later become a huge fan, you know. When they played, did they play more of their later stuff or did they get into some of their punk stuff from, you know, the Pink Flag days? Or what do you recall of the set?
And I have to say, first off, that I was a fan just like you. I knew them from their recent stuff. So of course I recall that stuff being played that was out at the time. Now, obviously their set was a little bit longer, so I think there was a couple of the earlier songs, but unfortunately I hadn't become a fan of their older stuff just yet. So it kind of went over my head a little bit. I remember seeing them. I remember enjoying the show, but I remember being bummed that it was sparse, even though there were a lot of people. Obviously, you're talking thousands of people, so it's probably bigger than any audience they ever had. But it just seemed very disheveled still. It was...
Oh, people were filing in with big, trays with all their drinks and, you know, still filing in for... Yeah, yeah. Well, I know. I always feel bad when I go to a show and the opening band goes on and they're really good and there's only, like, a quarter of the venues filled, you know, for the show. But so it was kind of like that as they were playing.
Unfortunately for them, but like I said, they went on and they were troopers and they did their show without a hitch. So it was a good show. And like I said, it turned me on to some of their older stuff, which got me listening to their older stuff, which was really cool. But unfortunately, I think it went over the heads of most people that day because they were there for one or two things.
Right. Yeah. And it was great promotion for them. And Depeche Mode have said that they were Wire fans and that's why they wanted them there. And I believe they were a mute band at that time. I believe that record or a couple records were released on mute. So that was really cool. Thomas Dolby, though, well known, especially at the time, had a lot of singles, big singles right then. Any memories of Thomas Dolby's set?
Now, he did play his hits, obviously, the ones that everybody knew with She Blinded Me with Science and Europa.
Yep.
Favorite stuff. But he really, really did go into his new stuff with the Airhead, I think, is one of the songs. And there was another one that escapes me right now that was bigger then. But he really played that up and he kind of really dressed the part. He was very colorful and stuff like that. So I think he was trying to take that next to go into that bigger realm. So he was having fun and it was a good set because he did incorporate a good mixture of the new and the old.
Did audience response? I know probably still people were still kind of coming in, but did he seem like he was capturing the audience?
Especially when She Blinded Me with Science came on. I think everybody that was there, they're probably big music fans, but not everybody's aware of what everybody plays. But of course, when that came on, I think it grabbed everybody's attention. And I'm not sure where in the set, but I think it did grab it a little bit earlier, maybe towards the middle. So at least people paid attention a little more towards the end of the set. So,
yeah. And did it just seem like the place... You probably didn't even turn around. How often did you turn around and go, oh man, this place is filling up? Or were you super hyper focused on every moment of the stage?
Well, actually, because we were at the front there, I took it all in multiple times just because I just couldn't believe the enormity. You know, thinking back when I first started listening to them in, you know, we'll just call it 82, thinking, you know, I've got, excuse me, one or two other friends that like them. And the rest of the general public thinks, oh, you listen to weird music. So it was like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Around and see, tens of thousands of people, you're like, wow, this is something. So,
wow. And then OMD, tons of success here in the States. So I'm sure it wasn't a big deal for, you know, people to grab. I'm sure they got the crowd going. How, what do you recall of OMD's set?
Well, I think if I'm not mistaken, I think their greatest hits had just come out or was just coming out. I mean, of course, it was a greatest hit set. And their one big thing that stood out to me is that right at the beginning of the show, it was either the first or the second song, they had some major keyboard malfunctions where they had to stop. I mean, the actual show. Well, the song, because they were starting a song.
Oh, I think I watched a thing on that, like the Andy McCluskey, or I can't remember who was talking about. Like they had to loop something for like a couple minutes before they could get the keyboard fixed and actually get the show going. That's right. Something. Yeah. Was there any other technical difficulties after that you recall, or did it seem like everything goes smooth?
After they got that initial thing done, it did go smooth. What I do recall about the technical difficulties is it seemed, and I'm sure for them it seemed like forever, but of course, being in the front row, my girlfriend at the time just yelled out, if you can't get it fixed, just bring on DM. And I'm sure it was probably Andy, but he like looked up and he just started laughing. He thought it was funny, and I'm like, oh, thank goodness he has a sense of humor.
Yeah, that seems like something that always comes across with him. Okay. And I'm assuming you were a big OMD fan at the time, like we all were. I couldn't imagine you weren't. Were you completely, was that your first time seeing them as well as, you know, Wire?
It was. As a matter of fact, I mean, I was a fan of theirs for quite some time, but this was my first time getting to see them. And with the, like I said, the greatest hits that just came out, it was a greatest hit show, and I can tell you for sure that the energy in that, after the technical difficulties, obviously, the energy in that thing, they were the perfect opening slot for Depeche Mode, because they did get the crowd going, and obviously so with their popular songs, but the energy itself was just, they were the perfect hype man to have Depeche Mode come out after that.
So prior to this, the weather changed a little bit. There was talk of there was rain and kind of like tropical type. Were you getting like, oh man, what if this starts raining? You know, are we going to have a problem? Do you recall any weather issues from the show?
I completely recall that, because it was kind of like it was scripted. So it was a bright sunny day, not a cloud in the sky all day long. Of course, Depeche Mode are getting ready to come on the stage and the clouds roll in, as they usually do when Depeche Mode used to visit Southern California. You know, you never get rain in Southern California unless Depeche Mode is shut.
Yep. Now, I don't know if you read Richard Blade's book, but there's an interesting bit in it that was right before Depeche Mode were due to kind of go on. The police were freaking out. And if you don't know this story, I'll just give you a quick rundown for anyone listening. Apparently, the crowd was so revved up that, you know, the food fight broke out, bottles were being thrown, and they had to try and cool the temperature there. And I guess Richard Blade came out and was like, hey, you know, tried to get everything calmed down, and they did so that the show could go on. But apparently, I don't know if you heard this, but apparently the show was close to being shut down. Do you have any memories of or recall of anything like where they were trying to calm things down?
The funny thing that you say that is, obviously the one thing that stands out with the show was the food fight. It was massive and it was ugly. Luckily, we were the front row there and we were out of most of it. And from what I remember, I saw the bleacher section. It just seemed like stuff was flying everywhere. So I knew it was happening, but I don't really recall like that the show was going to be
like it was in danger of being shut down or anything.
Not know anything about that. And as a matter of fact, you know, we thought it was all in good fun. It was crazy with how much food was flying, but we just thought it was all in good fun. We didn't think it was that led it to that level or anything like that. So, no, we had no idea about that.
Well, the lights are going down and Pimp starts playing. What are you guys thinking? You're sitting there. I mean, you'd seen the show several times, so you knew what was coming in some regard. But what was the excitement level when that, when it's like, oh, it's happening, Depeche are coming on? What was it? Did it just, did the place explode, or was it just, how do you recall that?
It was kind of like, almost like the blood pressure just kind of started rising and rising. I mean, it was kind of like a tension thing. And you're right. I had seen the show 5-6 times prior to that over the course of a year. But obviously there was something different about this. To be in the front row was just surreal. It was something that I really didn't fully, wrap my head around until like the following days and stuff like that. It was just, you know, you're there for a Depeche Mode show. I've been to many of them, and but this was different. And so,
well, the excitement of being front row alone, it would be like not have ever seen it before, because what a way to see the show.
Yeah, for this particular show was just, it was crazy. And from a lot of people that don't know, they had fold out chairs. That was the front row. But we all stood on the chairs because.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because when you're watching the show, they look like they were really high up. The stage was really high. So I was going to say, do you feel like you missed some of the show, because the front row was seemed like it was so low down compared to them?
It was still a great view. You could see, obviously, you were looking up, but still had a great view. But as with everybody, jumped on the chairs. So we were kind of like at foot level by the time we got on the chairs, because they had that riser. But I couldn't have asked for anything more. It was definitely to see. I can't imagine looking back now not having those seats, just because those are ingrained in me and stuff like that.
When I think about the show, I think of a moment. My friend Dave at the time was living here in Northern California, and he went down to the show. And then when he came back, and one thing that really stuck out to him was during Somebody, the gap between sections where Martin, you know, where Martin stops and then he starts to sing again, was a moment for him where just the entire place was just like, either didn't see it coming or was just so moved by that break, that that was something he took away from the show that was just like magical. Besides the whole show, was there a moment in the show where you were just like out of body experience kind of thing, where you're like, oh, this is, you know, similar to something like he had? We all have those at shows. Do you recall something from the Rose Bowl gig specifically that moved you that way?
Absolutely. And it's going to be kind of cliche because it's turned into one of their biggest things, but it was the first time that I really recall the wheat wave, I guess, as they call it.
Yeah.
And honestly, it kind of does it justice in the movie when it pans the crowd and you just see just hands like crazy. But in the front row, and this is one of the times that I did turn around because they were starting to put spotlights out into the crowd, and it was just amazing. And to say that it did look like a wheat field was the perfect, whoever coined it, perfect, because that's exactly what it looked like. But it was perfect just because it looked just like a field of wheat and not people. And it was just crazy that we're talking about tens of thousands of people doing that. So that's,
well, the interesting thing about that is that movie galvanized that. And I always tell people, go to early legs of the tour and watch the bootleg videos on YouTube, because during Never Let Me Down Again, towards that section where the wheat wave, or whatever we want to call it, the fan wave, whatever, happens, they don't do it. Like, Dave does this like guitar thing, like, you know, and it's just, and I think the band described it as it was something that was just kind of evolving as they went along. And then by this leg of the tour, it was something he just kind of started doing, and it kind of started taking off. And now, you know, the first note when they do it, everyone waves their arms before he even signals that section of it. But I think that's what, you know, you were another thing you had a front row seat to, was something that kind of galvanized at every Depeche Mode live show. You know, that kind of made that. Anyway, I don't even know how to say it because I'm just so floored. Like, it's so cool to talk to, you know, prior to this, I've always wanted to do an episode like this and meet someone who was there that wasn't just, you know, off to the side, or someone who was a really cool perspective on the show. And, you know, we met in like some fan Zoom, and I'm just like, wait a minute, what? So I'm so grateful that you're sharing these thoughts with us. Is it weird to talk about being there, and not only being there, but being in the front row with the whole sign and being in the film? And is it weird to talk about that?
It definitely used to be, because you know, back in the day, we didn't have cell phones or anything like that, so there was nothing to document. So when you told people you were in the front row, sure you were. Well, now with when the album comes out and the DVDs and everything like that, and you're in the insert and you have the picture, people are like, really, that's you? How can you prove that? Well, I have pictures holding the sign standing outside the Rose Bowl and stuff like that. So I can put the two together and say, see, here's me standing sign outside the Rose Bowl. Here's me inside. So it's really cool to talk about it with fans of the band, regardless of whether they were at the Rose Bowl or not, because they can generally appreciate that kind of stuff and their instances and their meetings with the band and their shows with the band. But it's something, like I said, I keep going back to the word surreal, but it's great to talk about it now, hindsight, with the nostalgia aspect of it and stuff like that. But like I said, growing up, you know, people were kind of skeptical about all that kind of stuff, but now I have the proof. And so it's kind of to talk to people who are interested.
Now, one thing, to go back to a small detail, because I love the small details, and I realize I'm not the only one, because when people go to shows, they always post photos of the merch booth and all these things. What do you recall about the merch booths? I'm sure there was a bazillion of them, because they set merch records with that show. But what do you remember specifically about the merch? When you look at the merch booth, were you just kind of like, I want to buy everything? Or what did you buy, actually?
The funny thing was, is I think I only bought a T-shirt or two. Like I said, I didn't really grasp the magnitude of the day until after the fact. But I grabbed a shirt or two. But what I remember is that so many booths, so many people, and there was a lot of stuff to choose from. OMD had a good section. Obviously, Thomas Dolby and Wire, just like a little corner. But there was tons of stuff to choose from. But even more so, walking out of the stadium, the people with the bootleg shirts, that I did at that show.
Yeah. That used to be a thing. It's funny. That was a thing. Like, I never really saw that very often until I started going to the LA shows and seeing all the bootleg shirts afterwards. I know it happened here. I just, for whatever reason, didn't see it. But funny story, one time at the Shoreline in Mountain View, one of the bootleg guys, I was talking to him kind of in just, like, he was trying to sell us, and we were kind of humming and hawing about buying the shirt. And then one of his buddy goes, yo, you know, like, run or whatever. And he threw the bag of shirts in the back of our car. Like, it's the full big duffel bag of the shirts. And I was just like, we all froze. We weren't sure what to do. And once they realized that the, they weren't in trouble, or there wasn't the police or whatever, he grabbed the duffel bag. He's like, give me my duffel bag. Come on. I want this back. And we were like, yeah, take it. Just get out of here. I don't want a shirt. Go, just go. And we were just like kind of freaked out. But I see that more often now. But when I was in Los Angeles, when I lived there and went to shows there, I couldn't believe how many post-show bootleg shirts there were. It was incredible. Like, I didn't. It left. Did you buy any of those?
I did not. There's plenty of opportunity, because, like I said, not only just walking out and there in the parking lot, but obviously getting out obviously was a sea of cars, so it took hours. But
I could imagine.
It was almost like seeing lines of people on the side. You're thinking that, oh, they're getting in cars. No, they were, hundreds of people out there selling bootleg stuff, so they were everywhere.
Yeah. Do you recall like the car windows open and people just blasting, you know, Depeche Mode or?
Oh, absolutely. Between K-Rock and Depeche Mode, that we were at a standstill. It's in the summer, and even though we talked about we had a little a brief spell of rain and stuff like that, it was a nice summer night. So yes, the tops were down, windows were down, and the music was blasting.
Now, one last small detail, just to kind of paint a broader picture for people, because so many of us have been to shows, and I know you didn't leave much. You were kind of locked into your spot. But do you remember them or friends commenting on where like the food lines long, and was there frustration with all that, or were you just hyper focused again on this? You just didn't leave your spot much.
Well, I was hyper focused, and like I said, I'm sure that I did eat or drink that day, but I don't recall it. That was the hyper focused of that part of it. The one thing that I do recall is that a friend of mine did go to I think it might have been the restroom, might have been food or something like that, right at the time when Martin was singing, and he was out in front. And the reason I remember this is because somebody threw a teddy bear up on stage. And so it's sitting right. Oh. And of course, this was right after the rain, so it's a little bit wet up there and stuff like that. Martin comes to the front of the stage, kicks the teddy bear, and it comes flying out and kind of hits me, let's just say, in the nether regions there.
Where it counts.
You and some little kid a couple feet over from me comes running by and grabs the thing before I fully recovered so I could reach down and get the teddy bear. So Martin always has a place with me because he was able to kick something.
Wow. I'm trying to picture a little kid running around the front row now that, you know, here's Martin singing and then there's some kid like,
right. I say because we were standing on chairs, so he was like a little tiny guy running by just a.
Oh! I was like, did someone bring their family? Which would be amazing, front row with the kids. Well, so at the show ends, you get out. It's a nightmare getting out and everything. What are the next couple days like? Were you rubbing it in to friends who didn't go? Or you guys? How did you absorb such a? And I know it wasn't 101 yet, really, but do you just like? Coming down from that show, did it take a few days to just kind of process like what an amazing event that must have been?
Well, fortunately for us, like I had mentioned earlier, the four of us that were there were all in a band together, and we had one of our biggest shows happening in 2 weeks from that date. And for some reason, one of the guys thought, hey, I really loved hearing Nothing live. Let's do that. Let's add that to our set. Now, we're talking about people without computers and stuff like that, doing everything from scratch and
hand. Oh, yeah, yeah.
We had to focus for the next week just to get Nothing down to add to our set. So we kind of had other things to focus on. Now, myself personally, yes, the following day was kind of like that collective sigh. I can't believe this happened. But as you mentioned, too, it wasn't what it was yet. It wasn't 101. It wasn't the Rose Bowl show kind of a thing yet. It was just...
just a great concert. Exactly. Now, when you start hearing about the advertisements for the film and the soundtrack, were you guys like, wait a minute, we were in the front row. There's a good chance we might be in the movie. We didn't know what the movie was going to be like, but do you recall going, oh, we could be in this thing?
I do remember that thinking, or hoping that anyways, and it came true when they put out the live version of Everything Counts as the video.
Oh, it was the single, right.
Oh, correct. I think I saw that before. Obviously, the movie was actually out, and in the single, or in the video, we were in it for a split second, so I knew, okay, it was documented, we got in there, but that's all we knew at the beginning until the album came out, and yeah, it just kind of being blown away that drawing was front and center. And of course my friend who drew it just, you know, I think he was like on the verge of tears just because he was like, you know, I can't believe that this piece of artwork is now enshrined. And he was as big a fan as I am of Depeche Mode. So it was something to him for sure.
Where did you watch the film the first time? Did you go to one of the LA screenings or did you watch it? Did you buy the home video? Cause it was VHS when it came out. Did you buy the tape and watch it at your house?
Well,
as the charmed life continued with all of the things, I have a friend who had a friend who worked at Warner Brothers, and they were doing a private screening for friends, family, and stuff like that. And we got to go onto the Warner Brothers lot in one of the studios. And
so one of the screening room things?
Correct. And it was probably a 50-seat type of thing. And we were in there, and there was probably only 10 other people in there. So we got...
Oh, wow.
If I'm not mistaken, it was about a week before the actual time for the movie to come out. So we got to see it right ahead of time. And yes, to be able to see us 2-3 times in the movie and stuff like that. And then obviously when the stuff came out and to be actually featured in there in one of the pictures and stuff like that, it's once again, I'm just going to keep going back to my word that I love is that surreal moment, that surreal feeling that this actually happened.
Okay, I need details. So you're working at Music Plus. The CD comes in. Do you buy one right there? And then when do you open the liner notes and go, oh, that's us. Like, I need that story.
Funny thing was, is that, yes, I'm going to buy it when it comes out because I work at the record store. But my manager was very good. You can't buy it until the day of, even though we would get it in a day or two before.
Right.
But
your manager seemed very fair. I have to say.
But yes, it was somebody. I was actually working that day, so I'm selling them. And of course, I purchased one and just set it in the back room. I'm going to take it home. I was actually hit up by a friend who came to me and visited me at work and said, "You're in the liner notes." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And they're like, "The new CD. You've looked at the new CD. You know, you have it." And I said, "Well, yeah, I bought it, but I haven't looked at it yet." And they had it with them. So somebody actually came to me at work and showed me. And so I didn't even know it. So it was.
Wow. That's that must have been just to look at it like. That's wow. What a story. I mean, I'm so glad you're so open to sharing these details with us, because what a moment in time and just, I mean, everything. And I hope that poster. That what's your friend's name again? I'm sorry. His name slipped out of my mind. What was it? Yeah, I hope that poster he drew is in a vault somewhere in the Depeche Mode vault offices. You know, like, hopefully, you know, the limo driver just didn't grab it and toss it. They're like, they don't want to be bothered with this stuff. But wouldn't that be amazing if, you know, that resurfaced at some point? But I know, like, within the deck chair from Enjoy the Silence, and I don't know how many they had. They could have had like 4 or 5 of them, but I know like they gave one away at like a fan convention or something, because I know someone, I don't know if he wants his name said on the podcast, you know, so I'm not going to say it, but I know him as a social media friend who won it and has it, and it's autographed, and it hangs in his house. He has either the deck chair or one of the deck chairs they used in filming. So, you know, maybe they don't hold on to those things very much.
and that would be fantastic. And the thing is that we would definitely know whether it was a real one or a replica of it, because I do recall that when my friend drew it, he's like, "All right, we're all going to sign the back of it with our names. And just as a thank you for the music, I think we put that on there and then just put our names on it." So it would definitely be distinguishable if it was ever still around. And I'll just, since I don't think anybody will ever prove otherwise, I just want to believe that it's around somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I could. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much. Lastly, I know you and some friends have started a new Facebook group, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about the Depeche Mode Collective that you and David and Tusa and a few other friends have put together. So tell us a little bit about Depeche Mode Collective.
It's a new group on Facebook. We're probably about 2 months old right now, but we wanted it as just kind of more like a family friends type of environment. And instead of, sometimes you get these groups that, you know, might be 10,000-20,000, which is great. It's fantastic. But sometimes you like to keep that friends and family, and everybody gets along. And that's the reason why we called it Collective. And it's basically anything new, old, or in between with Depeche Mode, as well as things that we're inspired by. So we have artists put up their paintings or share their music or anything like that. You know, all different kinds of artwork. It's just talk about Depeche Mode a little bit. So yeah, between David Atusa, Karen and I, we got it going, and Matt over.
Karen, yep.
So yeah, we started this thing just to have a good time, and it seems to be working out. And just a note, if anybody wants to look it up and get involved, we're going to be having some things. We just announced a couple of things coming up. We're going to be having chats with Bon Harris of Nitzereb coming up in the next month or so, and he might even do a little performance for us if we ask him nicely.
It was so fun. I got to join you guys on the first collective Zoom chat, and we had a great time talking it up.
Yeah, and we have those chats as well. So we have a lot of interesting guests coming up. I can't say all the names right now because
they'll have to join the group to find out.
There's the teaser. But yes, we definitely have people that have either been with, inspired by, or something along the lines of a Depeche Mode connection. And we'll be having those as guests in the next couple of months. So please come on down and share your stories and arts and stuff like that, because we do have a good time.
And how can they find, you know, can, if you search a private group, does it pop up if you search it? I don't know. I should know that, but I don't know.
If you search Depeche Mode Collective, it'll come up. Now, it is a private group right now, and all it asks is that you answer a couple of questions just to make sure that you're not a bot. And they're just simple Depeche Mode questions, so nothing that you're going to get stumped on, but we just do that just to make sure that we've got real fans coming in and not robots to take over and stuff like that. So
yeah, I will say I've left almost all the Depeche Mode groups on Facebook and who I follow on Instagram and stuff, just because it was burning me out on the band. And so, but I joined it because you guys were doing it, and I was like, oh, this is cool. And I have to say, I am just enjoying having just a cool place to go where it's just people, kind of has that hanging out and talking Depeche vibe to it. And so, yeah, so if you're into that kind of thing, and I know like a lot of us, we join a lot of groups and everything, but it's kind of a fun one, and everyone's really supportive of everybody's projects and art or whatever they're sharing. Depeche Mode Collective on Facebook and Instagram, I believe, too, right? Yes, Instagram. So anyway, well, Tom, thank you so much for your time, your stories. We had a little audio trouble. Hopefully I can clean it all up in post like I'm some producer. The bulk of it is any little glitch we had, the people won't even care because the stories were just so great. And any other memories or things that we didn't discuss that you want to kind of mention?
Just that, you know, the nostalgia part of it, and that's why I'm glad that we have kind of started this collective thing, because we bring up the memories and stuff like that, because that's what we still have. I mean, a lot of us still have our posters, our t-shirts, our albums and stuff like that, but it's the memories that people can share. That's the fun part. And that's why I do enjoy talking to people on occasions doing this kind of thing too, because to hear other people's stories and where they come from, and because there are many more stories that dwarf mine, but they're just fantastic to hear. But that's what.
Absolutely. Okay. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
We're going to have to take Rose Bowl out of the equation. Favorite Depeche Mode show, you can only pick one, about any other time you saw them, what pops into your mind?
I'm gonna say that I saw them multiple times for the devotional tour, but the one in Auburn Hills in Michigan was quite
the Detroit crowd. Oh man, yes, that I guarantee that was an amazing show. Well, if we're talking LA, just real quick, sneak these in. Did you make any of the big LA Dodger Stadium violation tour, or had you already left the area at that time?
I did. I had left before then.
Oh, okay.
Rose Bowl was basically my last hurrah there, because I think I left LA in 89. So after that, it was Detroit shows. I went to Chicago shows, and I went up to Toronto shows. So.
Oh, man.
I got my shows in. It was just in different locations.
Oh, very cool. All right, well, let's wrap this up. I've taken too much of your time, but thank you so much for your time, your stories, and I know people are just going to love the details. And again, hit Tom up and everyone over at Depeche Collective on Facebook. And I might have to pull you in if to be my 101 expert if there's something comes up again on that and drag you back on. Tom, come back on the podcast. We need to talk about this. We need your perspective. So hopefully I won't have to put you through that again, but I really appreciate your time.
No worries. Anytime, Glenn. The pleasure was all mine.
Our guest tonight, Depeche Mode, their mega single mix there, Route 66, Behind the Wheel. Red hot song in nightclubs around the world right now. The original version of that is available on Depeche Mode's Sire Records album, Music for the Masses. And of course, everybody who talks with Martin and Andrew tonight will receive an autographed copy of the album.
And plus, Shadow, the band has given us a bunch of copies of their tour book to give away tonight.
Not now, great.
They're white and they look like a great big photo album. Got pictures of Depeche Mode, what, on the farm, kissing babies, at the lake, you name it. Anyway, it's a great gift for anybody who calls in tonight, and we're going to give them away tonight as well.
Excellent. Now, before we get to the calls, I got to ask you, you guys played a fantastic show at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena last night, sold out about 70,000 people. How did that go?
Very good. We're feeling the effects of it now, unfortunately.
Is that right? So what are you guys going to do now? Just rest up a bit?
Well, we've got our end of tour party tonight. So,
oh, really?
We had another end of tour party last night. So it's just end of tour parties every night.
That's working itself, huh?
That's why we're a bit slow today.
Yeah, kind of slow.
We've got a delay on our voice.
Well, I tell you guys, the lines are red hot, so let's get to the calls. First up tonight is Carissa from Mankato.
If you're a fan of synthesized music, you really should have been at the Rose Bowl in Southern California last Saturday. Depeche Mode wanted to end their 9-month world tour in a special way, and what they came up was the biggest synth rock concert ever, a celebration of some of the best in techno pop music.
Modern music takes over.
Yes!
Modern music did take over for almost 9 hours at the Rose Bowl, turning this concert for the masses into synthesized music's answer to the Monsters of Rock show. 70,000 fans turned out to see Wire, Thomas Dolby, OMD, and headliners Depeche Mode. It was the largest U.S. concert ever for all of the artists involved, and that made for some pre-concert jitters.
No, it's just another gig, really. You know, 70,000 people, who cares? And we started to have sex after.
Have sex?
Whoa! Freudian slip!
It's going to be a concentrated information projection, I think.
Just shows you how nervous I am. Oh, get me on that stage. Let me get it over and done with.
OMD got the crowd going with a set from their recently released Greatest Hits LP. And as the day went on, there were celebrity arrivals and premature departures by fans who let the excitement get to them. Finally, when the sun went down, the Boys in Black came on. And in this stadium setting, Depeche Mode were obviously the home team.
It's like they make you melt, you know?
I've been their fan since I was 16 years old.
It's just a one heck of a good show, I think. Don't you all think so?
Yeah!
It's the 101st on this tour, and we felt that we had to do something special after 8 or 9 months on the road.
So with this 9-hour marathon under their belts, are these synth rockers ready to join the Monsters of Rock?
We didn't have enough spandex trousers to go around, actually, and Whitesnake seemed to have bought most of the wigs in America, so we just couldn't do it.
And I think we sensed that Van Halen was a bit scared that we'd blow him off stage, so, I mean, you know.
Look for Depeche Mode to release a live album of their Concert for the Masses by year's end, plus a theatrical film of their world tour.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I had a lot of fun with it in a little time capsule, or an attempt at a time capsule there. Thanks, Tom, for all your stories, memories, insights, and especially your time. Just amazing. That was just a lot of fun. I hope you all enjoyed it. Again, that Facebook group is called Depeche Mode Collective, so just search for that and you can link up with Tom there and everybody else who are members. Highly recommend it. And I just wanted to say thanks to everyone for the kind words and messages on the last episode with the authors of the Halo book. And congrats, Kevin and David. The book is now out and you can order it on Amazon or wherever you order books. Or you can go to halothevioletorbook.com and get info there. So congrats to them. Very excited for them. And if you have a question for me, you can drop me an email.
It's Glenn, G-L-E-N, at depeche-mode.com, and I'll try to get back to you in a timely manner. You can follow Breathing in Fumes on all the social media platforms, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Breathe in Fumes. Got some more episodes coming up real soon. Thanks, everyone, for your support, for sharing the podcast, spreading the word. Really appreciate it, and grateful. Thank you. Take care.